This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. We are embarking on the one-year anniversary of college campus protests across America condemning Israel's genocidal war on the besieged Gaza Strip. Students and non-student supporters alike, professors and other campus staff, and actual campuses themselves have in many cases paid and continue to pay a steep price to be part of this movement speaking up for the Palestinian people. 1 year of arrests, harassment, detention, revocation of admissions, degrees, student visas, tenured professors fired, and institutions sanctioned if they fail to target the protests themselves. This is the reality 365 days into America's crackdown on pro-Palestinian student protests across U.S. campuses. And this is the focus of our Spotlight program. And now joining us is Rachel Hamdoun out of New York. Hey there, Rachel. Tell us, after a year, how did these protests take shape, spread so fast, authorities' response to them, and where are they today, Rachel?
It is very necessary for us to not only bring this issue to light, but to also see what the encampments and what the student movements have taught us ever since they began and what they're doing now, and how this is going to affect the future of activism in the U.S. I mean, the students did what other leaders and other governments really did not have the bravery to do, and that is to condemn and to call for the end to the genocide in Gaza by the Israeli occupation, which has been fully funded, fully supported by the U.S. These students, last April, they set up camps, they walked out of classes, and they were even joined by some parents, professors, even academics, and they caused this revolution that wasn't new to Colombia. They reignited the anti-war protests that started even way back in 1967 when the U.S. waged war on Vietnam. And it was really in the right, in the center of the Columbia University campus. And that movement kept growing stronger, kept becoming this bigger wave. And now we're seeing it, you know, transcend campus borders. But we're witnessing the aftermath now with the Trump administration only 4 months in, through the legal arrests of students like we've seen with Mahmoud Khalil, we've seen with Mohsen Mahdawi, detained Columbia students who remain in ICE custody. And even with Rumeysa Öztürk, who wasn't even a Columbia student, she was a Tufts University PhD candidate, but because she co-wrote an article calling on Tufts University to divest from the Israeli occupation, that got her an ICE detention as well. These are all illegal arrests, and these are all, they all fall under the suppression of free speech, which the U.S. ironically went to Germany to tell them that they're the ones that's suppressing free speech, but we see that on ground today, and we've learned that through the student protests. So this is why it's very important to recognize the one-year anniversary And especially with Yale University, actually yesterday they relaunched encampments following an announcement that Israeli occupation minister Itamar Ben-Gvir was going to attend the university. So there were so many lessons that we've learned, both as people outside of these academic institutions and as students who are within these institutions, because people have even become more aware of the little things, such as where their taxes and their hard-earned money is going. They're going to fund the weapons that are committing this genocide against the people of Palestine, against the people of Lebanon, and against the people of Yemen. We've even witnessed how much of a hold that the government has on the media. And we've seen that, of course, through the suppression of free speech. I mean, you know, people are and students are taking to the streets to condemn the Israeli war crime. Okay. But apparently, according to the U.S. administration, they can't do that. But the media, under, again, free speech, is allowed to call these protesters terrorists, quote, right, for doing so, claiming the carte blanche of anti-Semitism.
Rachel, I want to thank you for that pretty much introduction into our Spotlight program. Appreciate it. Very comprehensive, and thanks for joining us. Rachel Hamdoun, our corresponding and colleague there, joining us out of New York. And now for our guests. Joining us, Mr. Daniel Kovalik, author and human rights lawyer out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the U.S., and Charlie Gates, coordinator at Sami Doun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Lebanese capital, Beirut. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Daniel, we'll start with you out there in Pittsburgh. Hope you're safe and doing well. Okay, so a year now into these pro-Palestinian student protests across U.S. campuses, lambasting and condemning Israel's campaign of genocide. How do you see this chapter in U.S. history and U.S. student activism and the crackdown upon it?
Well, I think this is an unprecedented moment, certainly in my lifetime. I've never seen this type of crackdown on student protest, and I was a student protester, and as you can imagine, that was a long time ago. And I think back then we had a lot more freedom to do what we did. I mean, we might face some sort of sanctions for sitting in or whatnot, but this type of violent crackdown we're seeing by police, of course, the deportation of students on, you know, student visas because they speak out on Palestine, that's unprecedented. And so I think what has started is a protest for Palestine, and it still is, obviously. But it's now also become a protest for free speech rights, right? I mean, I think if this battle's lost, I think the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is lost. You know, we cannot allow this type of speech to be suppressed in the way that they're trying to do. And so we need to continue to move forward. So I think it's going to be a tough time. I mean, it's going to take a lot of courage for students to continue, especially, obviously, students who are from outside the United States. They risk a lot doing that. But even citizens, I'll just give you an example here in Pittsburgh. At the University of Pittsburgh, they've tried a couple encampments, and it's largely failed because the second time they tried, about 20-some people were arrested, and a lot of them, by the way, were people in the community. They weren't students. And many of those are facing felony charges. And in Pittsburgh, 20 people, that's a huge percentage of our peace activists. So that's really chilled a lot of activism, particularly at the university level. I imagine that's happened at other places, too. So, you know, we'll see how this progresses, but I definitely think the students are on the front lines of a very righteous struggle here.
Right on. Thank you there, Daniel. And Charlotte, welcome to the program. Thank you for your patience there. A year of sit-ins, Charlotte, encampments, walkouts, and how do you see this chapter, as I put it to Daniel earlier, of student activism? And do you feel it makes a difference? Because a year back in 1970, there was the Vietnam War protests in America as Richard Nixon, president at the time, decided he's gonna expand the war into Cambodia. You know what? There was policy shifts. Even when there was a protest against apartheid South Africa, they were successful in getting the university where those things, those protests took place to completely divest from the South African institutions of higher learning. But we haven't seen that kind of success with these rallies, but nevertheless, the students have held a steadfast in continuing to protest. Your initial thoughts, Charlotte?
Well, one of the things that's been very striking about this movement is the vast level of support that it has actually garnered from amongst, for example, the student population or the public as a whole. And it's been that vast support that's been hit with this repression from both university administrations and, of course, local governments, local police, and the federal government and federal police.
Okay, it seems like we have a tech.
So this form of repression is happening across the board. For example, at McGill University, Canada, over 80.
All right, go ahead and continue. We're going to see if we can get this resolved. Go ahead and continue, Charlotte. If I notice we can't get this technical issue resolved, we'll have you log off and log back on. Go ahead.
Okay. At McGill University in Canada, over 80% of the student population voted for student union to divest from the Zionist regime. And what we're seeing now is the university administration, the independent student union, in order to prevent this resolution from existing. The same thing happened at the University of California at Davis, where there's been an attempt to dismantle the student government of the law school because of passing a resolution in support of basic Palestinian rights. And so what we're seeing is these resolutions are passing at the student government level, and where they're meeting with repression is at the higher administration level and at the level of the government, at the level of the ruling class. And I mean, this makes sense when you think about the role that the universities are supposed to play in the U.S. empire, which is essentially to produce the next staff, clerks, and leaders of the imperialist project for the U.S. and internationally. And what we're seeing right now is a massive shift in consciousness as a result of this live stream genocide, massacre of the Palestinian people in Gaza. What we're seeing is a tremendous consciousness shift where people are no longer willing to go be the engineers of genocide. Instead, people want to graduate and be the engineers who are going to devise a way to end genocide. We always say that on the 7th of October, 2023, this was a historic day, a day that changed the world. And it was also a day when the imperialist powers, particularly the United States, saw their future hegemony and control and domination in the region threatened. And they were willing to do everything in order to preserve the future of their settler colonial Zionist illegitimate project in Palestine, up to and including genocide. And so when we're looking at the suppression and violence targeting the student movement across the United States, what we're actually seeing is aiding and abetting genocide. Just like the weapons that are being shipped to the Zionist regime, the police attacking and the criminalization of students and people's for justice in Palestine is part and parcel of the U.S.'s responsibility for genocide.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, I'm going to swing back over to you, Daniel. Meanwhile, if we can get our coordinator to try to resolve Charlotte's technical issues there while I speak to Daniel for a second. Daniel, I'm going to put the same question to you. One can argue that all the student activism we saw during the civil rights movement it for an end to the oppression of the African American community, the Vietnam War protests, the apartheid South Africa protests, that they all resulted in some kind of policy change, and if not, they streamlined some kind of change in dynamics of maybe something that was a ball that was already in motion, right? They helped basically reach a conclusion faster when it came to some kind of a policy impact. Why does it doesn't seem, though, Daniel, in our generation today, with this Gaza genocide protest, that the student activists are reaping the same dividends? Why not?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it's, you know, first of all, let's talk about the Vietnam protests for a minute. Those protests started in a very, you know, small form, probably around 1965 or so, a little mm-hmm. later. The war ended in 1975. That's 10 years. Right? Millions of Vietnamese died during that period. Tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers died during that period. The point is, you know, we're about, what, we're a little over, what, a year, about a year and a half into this now, which is terrible for the people of Gaza. I mean, I'm saying that to them, it must seem like 100 years. But again, if you compare it to Vietnam, it took 10 years for that war to end, and frankly, it was really the Vietnamese who ended it by winning, okay? So these things don't happen overnight. I think that the fact that the protests do exist are probably putting limitations on what Israel's doing in ways that we don't even know. You know, who knows? Maybe they would just totally... You know, they could carpet bomb the whole place probably.
So you're saying they are having making a difference, they are having an impact.
I think they are. Look, they wouldn't be smashing people's heads on US campuses if they weren't making a difference, right? They wouldn't care. They feel they have to deport people to stop this. I mean, obviously they're feeling the pressure. And I think every day that the genocide goes on and every day that people continue to protest it, Israel becomes weaker, and the U.S., their support for Israel becomes weaker. I just think that this is something where you will see the fruit be born, you know, again, in time. And it reminds me of something. Can I just tell you an anecdote I heard once, which I think is a great anecdote? You know, in Algeria, when they had their liberation struggle, which cost 2 million Algerian lives fighting the French, the great story, this woman says, you know, we didn't think we were ever going to win. We thought, you know, this was probably hopeless. And then she said one day, you know, the people occupying her home, the French who were occupying her home, they just left and left food warm on the table. The point is, it even surprised the French. These things okay. can have a way of succeeding, but there's no prescribed time for that to happen.
Well put. Thank you. And it seems like we have Charlotte back. Charlotte, I'm going to come back to you. Charlotte Cates joining us out of Beirut. Charlotte, Daniel mentioned earlier all the arrests, the detentions, taking away people's college admissions, canceling faculty jobs, revoking visas, putting kids up for deportation and whatnot, denying federal funding to the college campuses that are not doing the government's dirty work for them by cracking down on the protests. One can really ask, how can Tel Aviv have this kind of chokehold on U.S. society to force the country, the authorities, to violate the nation's constitution and attack their own?
I'm going to disagree that it's a chokehold by Tel Aviv on Washington. This is an alliance between Tel Aviv and Washington. The fact is that the U.S. views the continuation and protection of the Zionist entity in the region as its means to maintain, as the nuclear state that it sponsors, to maintain the division of the Arab people, to maintain the division of the peoples of the region, and to maintain control and hegemony over the future, the resources, and the self-determination of all of the peoples of the region. That's what they see the purpose of maintaining this entity for. And, you know, we're seeing that across the board, right? Normalization with the entity is part and parcel of the project of being part of U.S. domination and of essentially sacrificing one's own autonomy and the future of one's people to control by essentially the elite, the ruling classes of the United States. Because to be clear, people in the United States, students, workers, teachers, farmers, everyday people don't benefit from the fact that the U.S. is carrying out a genocide together with the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine. This is why we're seeing the protest movement growing so much. This isn't something that's far away from the concerns of everyday people in the United States. The vast majority of people don't want to see their tax dollars going to be used to slaughter children and women and men around the world. They want to see their tax dollars be used for education and healthcare, to be able to enjoy their lives, essentially, you know. And while the fact is that the United States has been built on a great deal of violence and exploitation, that isn't the future that most people want to see. And this kind of relationship is not one that's beneficial to the United States. In fact, even people who supported Trump are beginning to get outraged by the recent activities that are happening, because this doesn't seem like a very, quote unquote, America first agenda. If the America that we're talking about is, you know, workers and students and teachers and nurses and doctors and laborers and people going about their lives, that America doesn't benefit from this genocide. And what we are seeing, though, is that U.S. imperialism sees this genocide as essential to its future, and it's willing to destroy the future of its students and its youth in order to maintain that project.
And I'd like to put the same question, and Daniel, it's okay if you have the same take as Charlotte, but I don't know, I'd like to hear your thoughts. After over a year, Israel's committed every war crime possible against the Palestinian civilian population in Gaza, a campaign that the U.S. has armed and funded, given political cover to, given media cover to. So shouldn't targeting of your own student population and your own institutions of higher learning be the red line? Tearing up the Second Amendment, shouldn't that be the red line for you in your protection of Tel Aviv?
Well, yeah, I mean, if we had a government that truly cared about its own people and truly cared about the Constitution, they would not cross that line, but they don't, right? And I think, though, this is what this is illustrating to everyone, including the American people, is one, that Zionism is an evil force, that the U.S. support for it is undefensible, and that the U.S. is willing to sacrifice the rights of the American people to defend Israel, right? All these things are combining to really educate the American people to understand the nature of their own government, to understand the really terrible relationship we have with Israel that, as Charlotte says, does nothing good for the American people, does not advance our interests. Mm. In any way. And I think you're going to see a larger and larger movement of people saying we just can't tolerate this anymore, you know. And again, that's why you see the repression, because they know it. The state knows it cannot win the ideological battle. It cannot debate its way out of this. It has to use violence to win, because the debate has been lost. Israel has lost that debate.
And we're almost out of time. Charlotte, I really want to get this last question out to you. The crackdown by the Trump administration on these universities, pulling federal funding from universities like Harvard, $2.26 billion, Charlotte, Cornell, $1 billion, Northwestern, $790 million, Brown University, $510 million, Columbia, $400 million, Princeton, $210 million, University of Pennsylvania, $175 million, and all these institutions practically, Charlotte, have refused to do the government's work and crack down on these protests. Your thoughts on this quite symbolic stand by these university campuses against U.S. government?
Unfortunately, by and large, the administration of most of these universities has been doing the government's work for the past 18 months, especially prior to the election of Trump. Students have been kicked out of school. Students have been turned over to the cops. The cops have been brought into campus to beat up students, and all of that has been at the hands of university administrations. Faculty have lost their jobs. Grad students have lost their jobs. These administrations, actually, they were going along and being complicit, and then they got nothing for it in the end, except to be stabbed in the back by their own partners and by their own partners in crime. And that's certainly, for example, very much epitomized by the situation at Columbia University. The fact is that what the U.S. government is doing is essentially killing its own higher education system. It's degrading its own higher education system. And so it's only going to exacerbate the crisis in U.S. imperialism. International students aren't going to look to come to the United States anymore for their education. People are going to be looking to China. People are going to be looking to countries that are interested in developing their futures, not interested in turning their education systems into prison camps.
Thank you both. Very illuminating having you both on. Appreciate both having you both. Daniel Kovalik there joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Charlotte Cates joining us from Lebanese capital, Beirut. That's a wrap for this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghiba.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers and we raise our hands in supplications, so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah for every single human being is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, on Dialogue. So as we speak about the dialogues of Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, we stumbled upon this dialogue where an individual by the name of Ishaq ibn Yaqub, he puts forth various questions to Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. And they were questions that were too difficult for Ishaq ibn Yaqub to be able to understand or to be able to answer. And so in response, of course, Imam al-Mahdi, he talks about various things. One of the things that he replies, he says that as for the fuqa', which is a drink that is prepared from the extract of barley, Imam al-Mahdi says it is unlawful to drink this. And then he says, and as for the shilmab, which is apparently a non-intoxicating drink, and it is still used apparently in the present day, Imam al-Mahdi says that this is not doubtful. And as for your property, till you do not purify it, do not use it. And then anyone who wants to send it to me, that means the purified part of one's wealth that is taken aside, which is, I'm assuming, khums, and anyone who does not want to be separated from it, then what Allah has bestowed to us is better than what Allah has given to you. So what's interesting is that you have these jurisprudential questions that are being asked. Of course, while these other different issues are also being spoken about. But again, this being careful of drinks that are lawful and are not lawful, and, you know, sometimes drinks that we don't really know which side they fall on. But to be very careful about what we are intaking, drinking, eating, watching, listening, etc. But what was really interesting was this idea about property. You know, sometimes we have a tendency to not give khums or to not pay zakat, to not pay khums or to not pay the zakat at the end of the holy month of Ramadan. And so here, apparently, what we understand is that you're not allowed to use that property that has not been purified by the means of zakat and by the means of khums. And so when you're using that property, you are using property that is not pure. So it's a very dangerous and slippery slope that we find ourselves in, and again showing us the importance of paying zakat and khums. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes we think that we're doing a favor to Islam or a favor to Allah or a favor to the 12th divinely appointed Imam by giving khums. And here, even that is being answered by Imam al-Mahdi, where he says that even if you don't give this khums to us, what has been given to us, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, on behalf of the Almighty Allah, is much greater and better and more valuable than what you could ever give to us in the form of zakat or khums. And so what that means is that the khums and the zakat, these are things to purify ourselves, to purify our wealth, and they are a benefit to us more than it is a benefit to somebody else. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Remember Iblis? In the ayat of the Quran, Allah tells him, bow down to Adam. Iblis says, no. Imam Sadiq said, Iblis told God, oh Allah, just make me not have to bow down to Adam. I will worship you in a way no makhluk worshiped you. And God said, you don't make the rules. I tell you what to do. So the intelligent person, I'm going to now come to the, we're covering Iman, the second chapter, the faith of the intelligent, ayat of Quran. This is part of a verse. Let's see if I'm quoting the verse correctly. Brothers and sisters, can you turn with me to Surah number 3, Ali Imran, part of the verse, last part of the verse. Do you see this? Surah number 3, verse number 7. The faith of the intelligent. Let's see if you see this with me. Last part of the verse. Do you see this? Last part of the verse. Yaqulun, they say, amanna bih. We believe in it. We have accepted it. We believe in it. What do they say? Kullun min indi rabbina. All of it is from our Lord. Kullun min, right? What does God say? Wa ma yadhakkar. No one receives admonition. No one gets it. Illa, except ulul albab. Except for the intelligent. Intelligent people, when God has spoken, say whatever God said. Kullun min indi rabbina. I don't pick and choose.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The Israeli regime has attacked all areas of the Gaza Strip, while for nearly seven consecutive weeks it has closed all the crossings. banning the entry of food, fuel, medicines, construction vehicles, and essential supplies, driving Palestinians into multiple crises of starvation, displacement, and unmitigated trauma. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Amanda Bazarel, the emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Gaza, said, Gaza has been turned into a mass grave of Palestinians and those coming to their assistance. We are witnessing in real time the destruction and forced displacement of the entire population in Gaza. Since the Zionist regime resumed its mass-scale attacks on March 18th, approximately 1,700 people have been killed and more than 4,400 have been injured, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, as the last partially functioning hospitals remain out of medications, supplies, fuel, clean water, and are routinely bombed and attacked by Israeli regime forces. Around 420,000 Palestinians have also been newly displaced over the last 4 weeks of attacks. Before dawn on Thursday, April 17th, the Zionist regime airstrikes across the Gaza Strip targeted displaced families living in tents in three separate places in Al-Mawasi Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, Deir al-Balah in the central, and in Jabalia in the north. Journalists and eyewitnesses reported that the tents were engulfed in flames and the victims, including many children, were burnt alive, with bystanders desperately trying to put the fires out. A physician in northern Gaza, Dr. Ezzedine Shahab, who has been narrating this genocide on social media while caring for his patients, stated earlier this week that after 556 days, Gaza is no longer a place. It is an experiment, a question posed to humanity. How long can a population be bombed, starved, and displaced before it ceases to exist? And how quietly can this be done before the world looks away for good? Yahya Sobieh, a photojournalist, recorded this footage in the aftermath of an Israeli strike on a home belonging to the Hassuna family in Gaza City on April 16th, killing 10 Palestinians and critically injuring at least 13. On Sunday, April 13th, just after 1:30 a.m., the Zionist regime army issued forced evacuation orders to patients and medical staff inside Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City. And then the Zionist regime bombed it in an attack that Euromed Human Rights Monitor called the targeting of Gaza City's last refuge for the sick and the wounded, who should always be protected, and of medical personnel working under catastrophic conditions to save lives. In the dark, hospital staff and patients were forced to leave the hospital on foot. Israeli regime warplanes then launched two missiles at the hospital, completely destroying the lab, pharmacy, and emergency department, according to the human rights group Al-Mizan. The hospital's church and other sections also sustained severe damage, the group added. The attack resulted in the death of a 13-year-old child who had lost access to critical medical care during the evacuation. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, the attack completely disabled the hospital and destroyed its CT scanning and radiology services, which were the only such services available in all of Gaza City. Al-Ahli Hospital is one of Gaza's oldest medical institutions, established in 1882. Affiliated with the church in Al-Quds, it has long served as a vital healthcare provider for Gaza's population, Al-Mizan stated. It was the first hospital to be bombed by Israeli regime army in October 2023, killing hundreds of Palestinians in that first attack 18 months ago. And with no repercussions from the Biden administration and the rest of the international community, then Israel has bombed every single hospital and medical facility since. The recent attack was the fifth time Al-Ahli Hospital has been bombed. Dr. Sam Attar, a Chicago-based physician working at Al-Ahli Hospital, recorded a message for the Sky News correspondent Alex Crawford later in the day after the attacks. Recently, the Zionist regime also bombed the Kuwaiti Field Hospital in Khan Yunis, killing a medic and wounding 10 people. The Ministry of Health in Gaza said that the attack confirms the occupation's deliberate intent to inflict greater damage to the healthcare system and threaten the treatment of the wounded and the sick, even in hospital beds. The ministry warned that Israel's crimes against medical facilities will not cease as long as there is no firm stance from international and humanitarian institutions. Because of the Zionist regime's ongoing closures of the crossings, banning all of humanitarian aid, the director of field hospitals in Gaza told Al Jazeera that they have lost 99% of heart surgery services in Gaza. The Gaza government media office stated in April that the health situation is entering a phase of complete humanitarian collapse due to the systematic blockade and the starvation policy imposed by the Israeli occupation forces on civilians and residents of the Gaza Strip. Long lines at the remaining food distribution points have become a daily occurrence in all governorates of the Gaza Strip. The occupation has targeted more than 37 aid distribution centers and 28 food banks, which have been bombed and rendered inoperable as part of a systematic plan to impose starvation as a tool of war against civilians. What is happening in the Gaza Strip is not a passing crisis, the office stated, adding, but rather an organized crime of starvation that amounts to a war crime perpetrated by the Israeli occupation forces with international complicity and silence. UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, reported recently that medication shortages from Israel's blockade are leading to a catastrophe. The agency profiled several children who visit the medical point to have burn wounds treated and to receive essential medication. A physician who leads one of the agency's medical clinics in Gaza City said that standard medical protocols are simply not feasible here. Moreover, the doctors and caregivers themselves are displaced, having lost their homes, yet they continue to come to work every day, providing medical care to all who need it. We are doing everything we can, but the conditions are dire. We make do with what we have, but the severe shortages of medicine, painkillers, and other essential medical supplies pose a grave threat to the lives of our patients and exacerbate this medical crisis. On April 12th, the Gaza government media office stated that in addition to the banning of all food and medications, more than 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are being deprived of clean water, turning water into a tool of genocide and a weapon of slow murder. The Zionist regime has systematically targeted water infrastructure, halted supply lines, destroyed water stations and wells, killed water repair workers, and cut off electricity and fuel needed to operate water and sanitation facilities, the media office stated. The office affirmed that Israel's deliberate deprivation of the population of water constitutes a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, a crime of genocide, as concluded by the reports of the UN International Commission of Inquiry, and a flagrant violation of precautionary measures issued by the International Court of Justice, which called for ensuring unhindered access to water and food for residents of Gaza. Thursday, April 17th, was Palestinian Prisoners' Day. According to the Palestinian prisoners' rights group Al-Damir, 64 Palestinian prisoners and detainees have died in the Zionist regime's prisons and detention camps since October 7, 2023, including at least 40 Palestinians from Gaza and a child. The legal center Adala calls the number a staggering figure that reflects the scale of violence, medical neglect, and appalling conditions Palestinians face in Israeli prisons. As of April 2025, according to the rights group HaMoked, the Israel Prison Service is holding nearly 9,800 Palestinians under the classification of security detainees and prisoners. Al-Damir states, Israeli prisons and detention camps transformed into sites of vengeance where appalling torture methods and extrajudicial killings became commonplace.
Thank you. Desde el corazón de Asia Occidental, la hora de Irán te sumerge en el mundo persa. Conocerás